Hey, we are talking to, is it Don Zeminda?
Zeminda,
author of the legendary Harry Caray. Let's start with kind of 21 years now since Harry Caray's death. How do you think he's remembered right now by baseball fans? Because is it the Harry Caray who actually was on TV and on the radio, or is the popular perception of Harry Caray, has that, for better or for worse, been formed by Will Ferrell?
I kind of think he's been colored too much by the Will Ferrell imitation and his later years when he was a kind of lovable grandfather figure who led the crowd and took me out to the ball game, mispronounced names, got plays wrong, but was a figure of lovability. One of the reasons that I wrote the book was that I think the real Harry has kind of been forgotten. He had a career of over 50 years in broadcasting. His White Sox years were amazing. His Cardinal years were equally amazing. You could argue that Harry's a Hall of Fame broadcaster, but he could have been honored by the Hall of Fame for his work for any of those three teams. And one of the reasons I wrote the book was to tell the whole story, and not just the Cub years, which were great, but the White Sox and Cardinal years also.
Well, let's start in St. Louis with the Cardinals. Every stop in his career, Harry was the beneficiary or recognized the power of a media outlet with tremendous reach. And before we go to his national fame on Channel 9 when it was on cable in the 70s and 80s, let's start in St. Louis with KMOX Radio, the massive 50,000-watt signal that made the Cardinals easily one of the most popular teams in America. When baseball did not go all that far west of the Mississippi, the Cardinals were it, and KMOX was it when it came to professional baseball.
Well, that's exactly right. But one of the things that I found out in doing the book was that Harry was responsible for the growth of that network. At the time that he started in the mid-1940s, the Cardinals had a network of like 15 or 20 stations. By the time KMOX was up and rolling in the mid-1950s, they had over 100 stations on this vast network. And KMOX itself was this clear channel, 50,000-watt station. It was so powerful that Jack Buck claimed that he used to get letters from people in Africa and other Guam, foreign countries, who could listen to the broadcast. But it was Harry himself who really helped grow that network. He was just so incredibly popular.
And how did baseball broadcasting change during that time? Because in the late 40s and into the early 50s, this was still the era of you only got the hometown call at the ballpark when they were actually at home. This was still the time when if they were on the road, you were recreating a broadcast that was coming back via telegraph. Think of the famous Ronald Reagan story where the line went down and he had to keep ad-libbing foul balls until the play-by-play returned. How did sports broadcasting, the technology of sports broadcasting, change around Harry Caray during those years in St. Louis?
Well, one of the things I found out in the book was that Harry was really a master of these recreations. He used to do crowd sounds, the ball hitting the bat. He would know the layout of the stadium so that he could describe a fly ball in Crosley Field and give a description of where it landed in the ballpark. He was so good at this that the Sporting News claimed that people used to write in with bets about whether he was actually at the ballpark or doing a recreation. They really were convinced that he was actually there. And Harry got so good at this that the Cardinals, who were becoming more popular, decided to actually take him on the road. And I think it was 1947 was the first year that the Cardinals traveled. Even in those days, they only went to Chicago, Cincinnati, Pittsburgh, the cities that were closest to St. Louis. They still weren't convinced that it was worthwhile to have the announcer actually at the game for all the broadcasts. But Harry did those games. They were so extremely popular that eventually they started doing all the road games, going to all the stadiums. And then the rest of baseball actually followed suit from that.
And what was it like for Harry Caray, somebody who was from St. Louis, to become someone who owned the town for in the 50s and 60s.
Oh, he really did. And in fact, he was so popular in St. Louis that when Gussie Bush bought the team, Gussie Bush actually asked Harry if he wanted to become the general manager of the team because he thought Harry was the most knowledgeable guy about the Cardinals. Harry turned that offer down. I think he didn't need it. I think it would have been a demotion for Harry.
It's interesting. You mentioned that that Harry actually turned down an offer to become the general manager of the Cardinals because Harry Carey's successor with the White Sox, Hawk Harrelson, actually did do that. He actually did jump into the general manager's office, and he proved that as a GM, he was a very good broadcaster.
Exactly, exactly. Harry was exactly doing what he should have been doing.
Before we exit the St. Louis years, the urban legend, is it true that he was let go of the Cardinals from the Cardinals because of bad behavior with one of the Bushes?
Well, I couldn't really get to the bottom of it completely. Harry kind of danced around the issue for a long time, saying, "Well, I would be flattered if somebody like that was a young woman who was the wife of Gussie Bush's son. I would be flattered to have somebody like that interested in me." But he never quite confirmed it or denied it. Eventually, he denied it. Mrs. Bush gave a long interview in the late 90s in which she denied it. So they were close. They were good friends. They were family friends. I've never been quite convinced that there wasn't something going on. But what was happening in St. Louis at that point was that there were people in the Budweiser business who felt that Harry was not doing their brewery any favors by being so controversial. There was one incident in 1969 when the Montreal Expos played their first game, and Harry was on the air, and the Expos were playing in this old minor league ballpark. And Harry was complaining about the condition of the field and how baseball should be ashamed of this and the Expo should be ashamed of this. And people actually called into the station to complain about how unfair he was being to the Expos. And Gussie Bush actually wrote a public letter apologizing for what Harry said. And that kind of turned the tables a little bit. And I think he was at the end of his 25th year, and I think it had kind of run its course at that point.
So then In 1970, he goes out to Oakland and works for the first of two baseball showmen in the decade of the 70s, the first one being Charlie Finley and the A's, and that relationship just didn't work.
No, it really didn't. I think you got two big egos, and I think Finley was convinced that Harry would double the attendance in Oakland, which probably wasn't going to happen no matter who was the announcer. They were a good team, but not a good stadium. And really kind of a small market. Harry did his best, but it really just didn't work out.
Was it true that Charlie Finley tried to get Harry to change his home run call from Holy Cow to Holy Mule?
He really did. And Harry stood his ground. No Holy Mule for Harry.
So then after this bad year in 1970, he goes back to the Midwest. The White Sox are coming off their worst year in franchise history. They lose 105 games in 1970. It pushes their longtime announcer, Bob Elson, into retirement. And Bob Elson was a classic, extremely classic old-school broadcaster. And people often kind of criticized him for sounding half asleep on the air. And then Harry comes to the White Sox. And what was kind of how was he received initially in 1971? I think a lot of fans say his celebrity began in 72 when they had Dick Allen and were surprisingly competitive. But during that first rebuilding year, how did the fan base like him compared to someone who had been with the team since the 20s?
Well, I think the fan base liked him from the beginning, but it was tough selling in Chicago. In 1971, no Chicago radio station would take the White Sox as a client to broadcast their games. They had to cobble together a network of these little suburban stations. WTAQ in LaGrange, I think, was the big station. It went down to 500 watts at night. Bob Verde told me the story about trying to listen to Harry when he'd be driving downtown and how he'd have to change the radio station three or four times to pull in the broadcast. But even with that, Harry started getting good ratings. And at one point, the White Sox were playing a game on the West Coast. And even on this little network of small stations, Harry was pulling in a very significant amount of the audience. So he was really a hit with the White Sox from the start.
And then 1972, they're back on a 50,000-watt clear channel station. They're back on the late, great WMAQ 670. And you have Dick Allen and his giant afro. You have Bill Melton. You have Carlos May. They're in first place most of the year until Oakland passes them. And that's kind of the year that cemented Harry Carey, at least in the minds of Sox fans, was that first fun year of 1972.
Oh, I agree completely. It was a great year. And the last year before Harry came, White Sox attendance was less than 500,000. They were playing a third of their games
up in Milwaukee.
Because attendance at Comiskey Park was so bad. And within a couple of years, the attendance had more than doubled. And really, Harry had a lot to do with that.
And it sounded like as we got into the mid-70s, that the Allen family, which owned the White Sox at the time, they were getting kind of tired of Harry Carey's act. And I know Chuck Tanner, the manager of the team, definitely was tired of Harry Carey's act. And the story was, at one time, he was as good as gone. And then Bill Veeck buys the team in late 1975, rescues them from a move to Seattle. And his first order of business is, no, Harry Carey is staying.
Yeah, absolutely. But it really, if Allen had kept the team, Harry would have been gone. He more or less publicly announced it that Harry would not be back. But Bill Veeck, being a shrewd promoter, not really a great friend of Harry personally. In fact, when they were both in St. Louis, when Harry was working for the Cardinals and Bill Veeck owned the Browns, Veeck felt that Carey prevented him from acquiring stock that he needed to close the deal to get the Browns. Harry went on the air and said, don't trust this Veeck guy. Don't sell him your stock. Well, eventually Veeck got his stock and the team stayed in St. Louis. But Veeck really wasn't a personal friend of Harry, but as the businessman, he could see what Harry could do.
1976, one of the great traditions of modern baseball, or definitely Wrigley Field, is born when Bill Veeck decides to flip on a PA microphone to hear Harry Carey warbling through the ballpark.
Yeah, actually, I have to tell you this. One of my favorite things that I found out in researching the book was that when he was in high school at Webster Groves High School in St. Louis, Harry was a member of the Glee Club, and they even did the Pirates of Penzance. I wonder what role Harry played in the Pirates of Penzance. But yes, the thing with Harry singing the national anthem, Veeck thought it was a good idea. Harry was kind of on the fence about it, but it was an immediate hit, and it lasted the rest of his broadcasting career.
I remember talking to Nancy Faust a couple of years ago, and you know, organist for the White Sox, and she talked about how Take Me Out to the Ball Game had kind of disappeared from the baseball public at that time. And that usually during the seventh inning stretch, depending on where you were in the country, they would play Roll Out the Barrel, or if you were in the South, it was Thank God I'm a Country Boy. And Harry starting with Take Me Out to the Ball Game at Comiskey Park led to a revival in that song across baseball.
It's really true, and now it's played everywhere. And in fact, at Wrigley, they still play the tape of Harry singing it.
And in 1977, I would say it's probably peak Harry Carey. You have the Southside Hitmen, you have Oscar Gamble and his giant afro, you have the ridiculous, you know, Bill Veeck softball uniforms, and there's Harry, you know, now 5 years into the White Sox, and he's the leader of this celebration.
He really was. In fact, that was my year. I grew up a White Sox fan. And in 1977, I got so hooked on that team that I went to almost 40 home games. And I would try to sit close to where Harry and Jimmy were, because they were such great characters and, you know, carrying on throughout the game. It was really a thrill a minute with the team and with the broadcasters.
When did the partnership with Jimmy Pearsall begin?
That started in 1976. Pearsall was actually working for the Texas Rangers as a part-time coach and doing a little broadcasting. And once on a whim, when the White Sox were playing in Texas, Harry asked Jimmy to join him on the air. And their chemistry was so instantaneous that the radio station got the idea to start pairing them together beginning in 1977. And they were a hit from the very beginning. I mean, they were so incredibly controversial and fun that Ron Rappaport told me that when he was working at the Sun-Times, they would have somebody at the newspaper listening to the broadcast just in case Harry and Jimmy did something crazy that they would need to write about in the paper the next morning.
It's interesting. If you go on YouTube, you will find snippets of Harry and Jimmy and their play-by-play, but there is the complete broadcast of Disco Demolition Night, game one leading into Steve Dahl blowing up the records. And if you want a really good peek into their chemistry, that game is it. Because it starts off, they're commenting on the signs, and I didn't know you could say this on TV, because they're both World War II era guys, and it's 1979, and Harry's talking about how all the signs say disco sucks, and Jimmy's talking about this T-shirt that he's wearing that says outpatient, and they're joking about how everything is bad for their morals if they had morals. I mean, that's kind of that's if you want to find a finer snapshot of their kind of rapport, you'd be hard pressed to do it.
That's for sure. But you know, that crowd got so out of hand that Vec tried having Harry Sink tape me out to the ball game to quiet down the crowd, and even that didn't work.
And then did he do the bleacher broadcast in St. Louis, or did that begin in Chicago?
That actually started in St. Louis, like toward the end of his run. But he would only do like maybe one game a year. When he came to Chicago to the White Sox, he started doing it once a week. It was, I think, every Wednesday home game. And those seats were so popular and those broadcasts were so popular that it greatly increased the attendance.
And then before we move out of the White Sox years, I do want to, he did have a little, I don't know if you want to call it a brush with history, but a short period in which he had a woman doing play-by-play with him. He was partnered up with Mary Shane for a little while in the late 70s. You don't hear much about that pairing. I mean, did they get along together? How did that work?
Well, she did about 30 games that year, and Harry was really very supportive of her. And really, I've got a couple of game broadcasts from that year where Mary Shane does an inning or so. And really, you know, she was a new broadcaster, but she knew baseball, and she had some promise. You know, I think that was probably years ahead of its time. But Harry was very supportive of her and would have brought her back if it was up to him. But Vec really pulled the plug on the whole thing.
Well, I mean, even now, Susan Waldman on the Yankees games is still considered revolutionary. And, of course, Jessica Mendoza on ESPN still has to deal with nasty commentary from here and there. But back then, 40 years ago, that must have been, I mean, revolutionary. Probably doesn't even begin to describe what that was.
Yeah, it really was. Interestingly, after that, after ending her broadcast run with the White Sox, Mary Shane became a NBA writer, and she actually was one of the first women who was allowed in clubhouses and dressing rooms for NBA players. So she was a pioneer there too, and was much more greatly accepted than she was as a baseball broadcaster.
1980, we find in August, Bill Vec decides he's going to sell the team to Edward DeBartolo. That sale is voted down by the American League twice, and then they sell the team to Eddie Einhorn and Jerry Reinsdorf. And in 1981, it's interesting, when you know how that relationship ends at the end of that year, opening day at Fenway Park, Carlton Fisk hits the home run to put him ahead in his return to Fenway after signing with the White Sox. And you see Harry Carey acknowledge Eddie Einhorn in the stands. And what was that relationship like? I mean, we know it ended poorly. was it just simply a matter of Einhorn being a guy who had worked for CBS and who had this extensive broadcasting history that Harry Carey's style just didn't make sense to him? How did they get along during that year?
Well, Eddie and Harry actually got along reasonably well. Harry and Jerry Reinsdorf did not. Jerry was always a skeptic about, you know, what kind of people they were bringing into the stadium and that kind of stuff. Interestingly, Einhorn had the idea of starting Sports Vision, which was the original pay cable TV network. And he and Jerry wanted Harry for those broadcasts, and they negotiated with him very seriously to start broadcasting those games in 1982. And I think if they had offered him enough money and enough years, Harry probably would have done it. Harry always had this fear that he would lose his mass audience if he went to this small cable station trying to compete with WGN-TV. But I really think that he would have done it if the dollars made sense. But it was too much of a risk, and he had too much to gain by going to the Cubs.
Well, he was on 44 for most of his White Sox run, except for 1981. And that, like, one of Vec's final acts was he signed a 2-year deal with Channel 9. And so if the White Sox didn't get in the way of the Cubs, they would have a source of, you know, GNTV would have a source of nighttime programming, essentially, because the lights weren't up at Wrigley yet. Did he start to enjoy the exposure he was getting that 1 year on national cable? Was he starting to develop a taste for it and like it? And was that part of his decision to leave?
Oh, I think it was for sure. And of course, you know, WGN, that was not only was Einhorn trying to start a pay cable network, but that was when cable itself was just starting out and WGN going out to the whole country. That was a whole new thing. And Harry could see the possibilities there. And as a result of that, he became a national celebrity.
There is always some talk in you go on White Sox fan forums, and there's, you know, some what if discussions, and what if they managed to hold on to Harry Carey through 1983 and that winning ugly 99 win playoff season, and Harry's leading the celebration. How does that affect, would that potentially have affected Harry Carey's brand, and how would that have also affected the White Sox market share too?
Well, I think it would have affected a lot. I did a study of White Sox attendance versus Cub attendance, like through the 70s and then early in Harry's years with the Cubs. And even in Harry's early years with the Cubs, when the White Sox had a pretty good team, and except for 84, the Cubs did not, White Sox attendance was very competitive with the Cubs. And in fact, in some years, they actually outdrew the Cubs. But as the WGN superstation gained power, and as attendance started to increase at Wrigley Field, those tables were turned. And then it reached the point back starting like in the late 1980s where the White Sox could never outdraw the Cubs. Even in 2005, when the White Sox won the World Series and the Cubs had a pretty bad, typical, mediocre Cub team, the Cubs outdrew them. It's been, I think, 33, 34 years in a row that the Cubs have outdrawn the White Sox. People don't realize that back in the 70s and even in the early 80s, that was not the case at all.
And that 84 was, before we go, I'm jumping ahead, before we go to the decision to go to the North Side and the Cubs, 84 is kind of considered the turning point in where one franchise kind of steadily went in one direction, and then the Cubs just veered off and went into this entirely new space that never really existed in Chicago baseball before. The Cubs, they're a playoff team. They win the NL East running away. You have the Cubs are on Channel 9. You have Harry Carey leading the celebration. He's in the clubhouse. And for whatever reason, that changed a lot of minds in the city of Chicago. And for a generation of kids who may have been watching this whole thing unfold on TV, That cemented their loyalty.
It really did. And Harry became identified with the Cubs from then on, to the degree that I worked in sports broadcasting for a number of years, and I had a small group of younger people who reported to me, and many of them had no idea that Harry even worked for the White Sox, much less the Cardinals.
But Harry, we talk about the caricatures of, between Will Ferrell or Ryan Dempster, or everyone tries, when they do Harry Carey, it's the Harry Carey of the 90s. And you kind of forget what a savvy broadcaster and businessman he was. He knew how to manage Harry Carey Inc. really well. And he saw a lot of trends before a lot of other people.
Yeah, he really did. I mean, he became a television broadcaster primarily in 1973. He never looked back. He would do a few innings on radio, but he saw the possibilities of television. He saw the possibilities of marketing. One of the funny stories that I have in the book is when he went to the Cubs, he actually had a soft drink called Holy Cow. And they tried to get Harry to lead a cow by a rope as a kind of publicity stunt. And Mr. Holy Cow was terrified of the cow and wouldn't do it. And the soft drink tanked. But at the same time he was doing that, he was also opening his restaurant. And that became extremely successful for him.
In 1978, there was a Sports Illustrated profile of Harry Carey that talks about him kind of at the peak of his White Sox celebrity, where he's walking down Rush Street drinking a pina colada. I mean, the writer paints it just a terrific picture of what life was like for Harry Carey that year, and that even the working women of Rush Street, they'd proposition him, then say, "Oh, you're Harry Carey. Let's talk about baseball." And then a couple of weeks later, the letters to the editor were either from White Sox fans who loved it or Cubs fans who said, "This sideshow is ridiculous. If I want a good, classy broadcast, I want Jack Brickhouse and Vince Lloyd and Lou Boudreau, and it's no nonsense, and they know how to call a game professionally." And then, wouldn't you know it, 4 years later, Jack Brickhouse retires, and here's Harry Carey inside WGN. Talk about that clash of cultures when Harry not only went to the North Side, but also went to this this very powerful TV and, let's face it, radio entity at the time.
Well, really, there were people inside the Tribune Company who were very much against the idea of Harry going to the Cubs. And it really took a few months before the resistance was finally worn down and they agreed to do it. But, it was a gamble. And in fact, they had brought in Milo Hamilton the year before, who was designated to be Jack Brickhouse's successor. So they sort of had a fallback position if Harry didn't work out with the Cubs, but it really did. And one of the interesting things that I found out in doing the book was when Harry went to the Cubs in 1982, the Tribune did a survey of Cubs fans, White Sox fans, neutral fans, asked them, "What do you think of this move?" And incredibly, 44% of the people who identified themselves as White Sox fans said they were now open to rooting for the Cubs just because of Harry. At the same time, people who identified themselves as Cub fans, they weren't so sure about this Harry guy. But, as soon as they started hearing him, they came on board also.
Well, that it was interesting. Bob Logan's book about the 83 White Sox, which also kind of went into all the machinery of the sale to Reinsdorf, said that for years after Harry left, you'd have these drunks who would sit in front of the broadcast booth at Comiskey and say, "Hey, Harry!" He was like that much of a figure on the South Side of Chicago.
Yeah, he really was. And in fact, as I mentioned, I spent a lot of the time in the 77 season at the ballpark, and Vec used to call it the world's biggest saloon. And there was just kind of a fun-loving atmosphere, and Harry really contributed to that a lot.
As the 80s roll on, Harry has kind of cemented himself as with icon status in Chicago as a broadcaster, as a businessman. And then his health starts to give out on him. As would any man who was what, in his late 60s, early 70s then?
That's right. Yeah, he had the stroke to begin with in the early 1980s. And for a time, they weren't sure whether he could continue working. And in fact, when he came back, they started to think that maybe he should just do home games only. But now Harry was convinced that he could do the whole thing. He went on, and it really wasn't until the last couple years of his life when his health really started deteriorating that he cut back a little bit. But I talked to a number of the younger broadcasters that he worked with, people like Dwayne Statz and Tom Brenneman and Bob Brenly, and they used to tell me, we couldn't keep up with Harry. He's 40, 50 years older than we are. We can't keep up with him.
And was it, President Reagan, did he fill in for Harry when he was in the hospital, or was that after he came back?
No, that was after he came back. The way it unfolded was that when Harry came back from the stroke, they had had people like Billy Crystal and famously Bill Murray, Bob Costas, other people filling in for Harry. And then he came back in late May. On his first broadcast on WGN, President Reagan actually phoned in to the radio station to welcome Harry back. And they had a little back and forth that lasted a few minutes. Everybody loved it. And then the next year, when President Reagan was running for re-election, he came to Chicago to do some campaign appearances. And Harry invited him to come to the station and join him in a little play-by-play. They did about an inning together, and it was great fun.
Well, because Reagan himself had did Cubs play-by-play in Iowa, I think in Des Moines, or was it in?
I believe it was Des Moines.
In Des Moines,
yes.
And while all this was going on, was he still a person in good standing in St. Louis, or did the rivalry turn on him?
Well, I don't know if the rivalry turned on him, but he was succeeded by Jack Buck, who had played second fiddle to Harry for about 15 years. And Buck was a great and famous broadcaster in his own right. And once Buck got the chair to himself, he's the guy who became identified with the Cardinals. And in fact, people talk about the statue of Harry outside Wrigley Field. Jack Buck actually had a statue of himself outside Busch Stadium in St. Louis, even before Harry's statue.
As we get into the 90s, and this is kind of the era of Harry Caray that I remember, where it's the players' names backwards, it's occasionally forgetting details, but by that point he had built up so much goodwill that he was basically forgiven. Was there any attempt by WGN or the Cubs to kind of nudge him into retirement, or was that totally out of the question?
No, he was just too popular. I mean, they were open to the idea of him doing home games only, which is what he did, I think, the last year or two that he was broadcasting. But there was never a thought of moving Harry out of the chair. He was just too popular.
If Harry made it through that dinner in 1998 and was good to go for opening day, was the plan to keep him with the team through 1998 and beyond?
I think there was, yeah. Yeah, in fact, Harry used to say, you know, bury me at the ballpark. You know, I'll do a broadcast, fall over, carry me away, I'm done. But I'm going to be doing it up until my last days.
Is it possible, his popularity, we mentioned before, he had an ability to ride the waves of technological innovation, whether it's the evolution of baseball on the radio in St. Louis in the 50s, cable television in the late 70s and early 80s, and he knew how to leverage his own star via those innovations. Is it even possible to have that kind of reach today, even in baseball broadcasting, to the extent that Harry Caray did way back when?
No, not for somebody who was primarily a local broadcaster. I just don't think it could happen anymore. I mean, he was just the right man at the right time every step of the way.
I mean, I've known Len Casper since we worked together in Milwaukee, and he's firmly cemented himself in kind of the Cubs broadcaster pantheon, and he managed to do something that Jack Brickhouse and Harry Carey didn't, and that was broadcast a World Series season. But could you? I mean, because it was even with that resume. And the ability to be around for this era of Cubs baseball. I mean, could Len open a restaurant to the same extent that Harry Carey did?
No, I don't think so. There'll never be anybody like Harry again, I don't think.
Also, are personalities being pushed out of the broadcast booth? Because it seems you always Harry came from this era of the Vin Scullys and the Red Barbers, the nice young man who will just tell you what's going on in the baseball game, and didn't really put themselves into it all that much. And Harry Carey was a full-blown personality. And then other cities had their personalities. Hawk Harrelson retiring last year, definitely another personality in the game. And sometimes you have baseball players who try to be personalities, and then they come off as either cranky or boorish. Is it possible to be a personality in today's sports broadcasting environment, or is that something? Is that an era whose time has passed?
I think it's an era whose time has passed. But one thing you have to realize is that the Harry who broadcast for the Cubs was different from the Harry who broadcast for the White Sox and the Cardinals. He toned down his act, really to a significant degree. I mean, he could still be critical of ball players. He could still say, get him out of here. But it wasn't like was with the White Sox, where he was openly feuding with the manager of the team, where he was calling the owner of the team an idiot, where he was so derisive of Bill Melton that when Melton got traded to the Angels, Melton said, "I'm glad they traded me, because if they didn't traded me, I would have retired because of the man upstairs," meaning Harry. Those days were gone by the time he was established with the Cubs. He could still be honest. He could still be critical. But he was definitely a different Harry than he was in his past teams.
Oh, you mentioned that. There's a video of a pregame show, a White Sox pregame show from 1974. And it's Harry, they're in Texas. And this must have been after Dick Allen quit. And it's Harry and Roland Hemond, the general manager of the White Sox, talking about what had happened. And the degree of open contempt they had for Dick Allen. A guy who really did good work for that organization was mind blowing.
Yeah, I mean, you could argue that Dick Allen, along with Harry, saved the White Sox franchise in Chicago, because they could have easily gone out of business within a few years. But and in fact, in Allen's first year with the White Sox, Harry was a big supporter of him. And in fact, the next year, I mean, they brought in Hank Allen, Dick's brother, as a bench warmer and friend of Dick Allen. And Harry was even open to that and talking about, you know, what a good guy Hank Allen is to have around the clubhouse, and the White Sox are lucky to have him along with Dick. But that relationship soured pretty quickly. And you're right. By the time Allen left, I mean, Harry was just contemptuous of Allen. I mean, there was one point where Allen showed up late for a game, and then Harry sees Allen in the on-deck circle, and he says, "Well, Dick decided to show up on time today."
Well, going into his business acumen, you talk about the restaurant, and then it's funny, given his history with the Bush family in the 60s and how even before kind of the whispers of scandal that surrounded his departure, that the Bush family had kind of soured on him. You know, by the late 80s, you know, Cub fan, Bud man, sunglasses, doing the dancing on TV. Even before that, one of the little pieces of pop culture trivia that exists in Chicago is in 1977, at the height of the Southside Hitmen, some band decides to record disco versions of Take Me Out to the Ball Game and Na Na Hey Hey Goodbye. And he just goes into a recording studio, does his patter, and then collects his check and leaves. I mean, that was that was part of Harry Carey Inc.
Yeah, exactly. And in fact, that even went back to the St. Louis years. There was a song called the Harry Carey Polka that was briefly popular in St. Louis.
It's when you go to the Wrigley Field today and you see this generation of Cub fans, the people who grew up, they don't remember Harry Carey. They don't remember Jack Brickhouse. They don't remember Skip Carey. For them, their Cub fan experience began with Len Casper, and their heroes are Chris Bryant and Anthony Rizzo. And you can see them later in life talking about this era like some golden era of baseball. And yet, they participate in the one Harry Carey tradition that continues. If you could talk to Harry Carey right now, and not Jim Volkman doing the impersonation, but the actual Harry Carey, he'd probably be pretty thrilled with that.
Oh, I think he would be. Yeah, it's keeping him alive.
Okay, anything else you want to add?
No, only that it was an incredible experience writing about Harry. What an amazing life the guy had. He lived until the age of 84, but he had experiences that were like hundreds of years for anybody else.
All right.
Thank you very much, Don. This was a 45-minute conversation. I had no idea.
I had no idea. I always tell that client.
Thank you very much.